took place when you needed to take a shit or something. An existence where there weren't even any chapters. Very untidy, Paul croaked. Good thing there's guys like me, just to keep things rinsed, he cackled. The champagne bottle hadn't been in the scenario, but that was minor compared with a woman's hideous vitality and his current painful uncertainty. And until he knew whether or not she was dead, he couldn't burn the house down, making a beacon that would bring help on the run. Not because Annie might still be alive. He could roast her alive with no qualms at all. It wasn't Annie that was holding him back. It was the manuscript. The real manuscript. What he had burned had been nothing more than an illusion with a title page on top. Blank pages interspersed with written rejects and culls. The actual manuscript of Misery's Return had been safely deposited under the bed, and there it still was. Unless she's alive. If she's alive, maybe she's in there reading it. So what are you going to do? Wait right in here, part of him advised. Right in here where it's nice and safe. But another braver part of him urged him to go through with the scenario. As much of it as he could, anyway. Get to the parlor. Break the window. Get out of this awful house. Work his way to the edge of the road and flag down a car. Under previous circumstances, this might have meant waiting for days, but not anymore. Annie's house had become a drawing card. Summoning all of his courage, he reached for the doorknob and turned it. The door swung slowly open on darkness. And yes, there was Annie. There was the goddess, standing there in the shadows, a white shape in a nurse's uniform. He blinked his eyes tightly shut and then opened them. Shadows, yes. Annie, no. Except in the newspaper photographs, he had never seen her in her nurse's uniform. Only shadows. Shadows and so vivid. Imagination. He crawled slowly into the hall and looked back down toward the guest room. It was shut, blank, and he began to crawl toward the parlor. It was a pit of shadows. Annie could be hidden in any of them. Annie could be any of them. And she could have the axe. He crawled. There was the overstuffed sofa, and Annie was behind it. There was the kitchen door standing open, and Annie was behind that. The floorboards creaked in back of him. Of course. Annie was behind him. He turned, heart hammering, brain squeezing at his temples. And Annie was right there, all right, the axe upraised, but only for a second. She blew apart into shadows. He crawled into the parlor, and that was when he heard the drone of an approaching motor. A faint wash of headlights illuminated the window, brightened. He heard the tires skid in the dirt, and understood they had seen the chain she had strung across the driveway. A car door opened and shut.
Shit! Look at this!
He crawled faster, looked out, and saw a silhouette approaching the house. The shape of the silhouette's hat was unmistakable. It was a state cop. Paul groped on the knick-knack table, knocking figurines over. Some fell to the floor and shattered. His hand it held the roundness novels delivered precisely because life so rarely did. It was the penguin sitting on his block of ice. Now my tale is told. The legend on the block read. And Paul thought, yes. Thank God. Propped on his left arm, he made his right hand close around the penguin. Blisters broke open, dribbling pus. He drew his arm back and heaved the penguin through the parlor window, just as he had thrown an ashtray through the window of the guest bedroom not so long ago. Here! Paul Sheldon cried deliriously. Here, in here! Please, I'm in here! There was yet another novelistic roundness in this denouement. They were the same two cops who had come the other day to question Annie about Kushner, David and Goliath. Only tonight David's sport coat was not only unbuttoned, his gun was out. David turned out to be Wicks. Goliath was McKnight. They had come with a search warrant. When they finally broke into the house in answer to the frenzied screams coming from the parlor, they found a man who looked like a nightmare sprung to life. There was a book I read when I was in high school, Wicks told his wife early the next morning. Count of Monte Cristo, I think. Or maybe it was The Prisoner of Zenda. Anyway, there was a guy in that book who'd spent 40 years in solitary confinement. He hadn't seen anybody in 40 years. That's what this guy looked like. Wicks paused for a moment, wanting to better express how it had been, the conflicting emotions he had felt, horror and pity and sorrow and disgust. Most of all, wonder that a man who looked this bad should still be alive. He could not find the words. When he saw us, he started to cry, he said, and finally added, he kept calling me David. I don't know why. Maybe you look like somebody he knew, she said. Maybe so. Paul's skin was gray, his body rack thin. He huddled by the occasional table, shivering all over, staring at them with rolling eyes. Who? McKnight began. Goddess. The scrawny man on the floor interrupted. He licked his lips. You have to watch out for her. Bedroom. That's where she kept me. Bet Ryder. Bedroom. She's there. Annie Wilkes. Wicks. In that bedroom? He nodded toward the hall. Yes. Yes, locked in. But of course, there's a window. Who? McKnight began a second time. Christ, can't you see? Wicks asked. It's the guy Kushner was looking for. A writer. Can't remember his name, but it's him. Thank God, the scrawny man said. What? Wicks bent toward him, frowning. Thank God you can't remember my name. I'm not tracking you, buddy. It's all right. Never mind. Just you have to be careful. I think she's dead. But be careful. If she's still alive, dangerous like a rattlesnake. With tremendous effort, he moved his twisted left leg directly into the beam of McKnight's flashlight. Cut off my foot. Axe. They stared at the place where his foot wasn't for long, long seconds. And then McKnight whispered, Good Christ! Come on, Wicks said. He drew his gun and the two of them started slowly down the hall to Paul's closed bedroom door.
Watch out for her!
Paul shrieked in his cracked and broken voice.
Be careful!
They unlocked the door and went in. Paul pulled himself against the wall and leaned his head back, eyes closed. He was cold. He couldn't stop shivering. They would scream or she would scream. There might be a scuffle. There might be shots. He tried to prepare his mind for either. Time passed, and it seemed to be a very long time indeed. At last he heard booted feet coming back down the hall. He opened his eyes. It was Wicks.
She was dead,
Paul said.
I knew it. The real part of my mind did. But I can still hardly believe.
Wicks said. There's blood and broken glass and charred paper in there. But there's no one in that room at all. Paul Sheldon looked at Wicks. And then he began to scream. He was still screaming when he fainted. goddess. You will be visited by a tall, dark stranger. The gypsy woman told Misery. And Misery, startled, realized two things at once. This was no gypsy, and the two of them were no longer alone in the tent. She could smell Gwendolyn Chastain's perfume in the moment before the mad woman's hands closed around her. In fact, the gypsy who was not a gypsy observed, I think she is here now. Misery tried to scream, but could no longer in-breathe. Misery's child. It always looked that way, Boss Ian, Ezekiel said. No matter how you look at her, she seemed like she's looking at you. I don't know if it be true, but the Borkas, they say even when you get behind her, the goddess, she seemed to be looking at you. But she is, after all, only a piece of stone, Ian remonstrated. Yes, Boss Ian. Ezekiel agreed. Dad would give her her power. Misery's return. Number one. You're number one. These sounds, even in the haze. Now I must rinse, she said. And this is how it rinses out. 9 months after Wixon McKnight carried him from Annie's house on a makeshift litter, Paul Sheldon was dividing his time between Doctor's Hospital in Queens and a new apartment on the east side of Manhattan. His legs had been rebroken. His left was still in a cast from the knee down. He would walk with a limp for the rest of his life, the doctors told him. But he would walk. And eventually he would walk without pain. His limp would have been deeper and more pronounced if he had been walking on his own foot instead of a custom-made prosthesis. In an ironic sort of way, Annie had done him a favor. He was drinking too much and not writing at all. His dreams were bad. When he got out of the elevator on the 9th floor one afternoon in May, he was for a change thinking not of Annie, but of the bulky package tucked clumsily under his arm. It contained 2 bound galleys of Misery's return. His publishers had put the book on a very fast track, and considering the worldwide headlines generated by the bizarre circumstances under which the novel had been written, that was hardly surprising. Hastings House had ordered an unprecedented first printing of 1,000,000 copies. That's only the beginning, Charlie Merrill, his editor, had told him at lunch that day, the lunch from which Paul was now returning with his bound galleys. This book is going to outsell everything in the world, my friend. We all just ought to be down on our knees, thanking God that the story in the book is almost as good as the story behind the book. Paul didn't know if that was true, and didn't really care anymore. He only wanted to get it behind him and find the next book. But as dry days became dry weeks, became dry months, he had begun to wonder if there ever would be a next book. Charlie was begging him for a non-fiction account of his ordeal. That book, he said, would outsell even Misery's Return. Would, in fact, outsell Iacocca. When Paul asked him out of idle curiosity what he thought the paperback rights for such a book might fetch, Charlie brushed his long hair away from his forehead, lit a Camel, and said, I believe we could set a floor at $10 million and then conduct one hell of an auction. He did not bat an eye when he said it. After a moment or two, Paul realized he either was serious or thought he was. But there was no way he could write such a book. Not yet. Probably not ever. His job was writing novels. He could write the account Charlie wanted, but to do so would be tantamount to admitting to himself that he would never write another novel. Then the joke is, it would be a novel, he almost said to Charlie Merrill, and then held back at the last moment. The joke was, Charlie wouldn't care. It would start out as fact, and then I begin to tart it up. Just a little at first. Then a little more. Then a little more. Not to make myself look better, although I probably would. And not to make Annie look worse. She couldn't. Simply to create that roundness. I don't want to fictionalize myself. Writing may be masturbatory, but God forbid it should be an act of auto-cannibalism. His apartment was 9E, farthest from the elevator, and today the corridor looked 2 miles long. He began to stump his way grimly down to it, a T-shaped walking stick in each hand. Clack, 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 clack. God, he hated that sound. His legs ached sickeningly, and he yearned for Novril. Sometimes he thought it would be worth being back with Annie just to have the dope. The doctors had weaned him from it. The booze was his substitute. And when he got inside, he was going to have a double bourbon. Then he would look at the blank screen of his word processor for a while. What fun. Paul Sheldon's $15,000 paperweight. Clack. 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 Now to get the key out of his pocket without dropping either the manila envelope containing the bound galleys or the sticks. He propped the sticks against the wall. While he was doing that, the galleys dropped out from under his arm and fell to the rug. The envelope split open. Shit, he growled. And then the sticks fell over with a clatter, adding to the fun. Paul closed his eyes, swaying unsteadily on his twisted, aching legs, waiting to see if he was going to get mad or cry. He hoped he would get mad. He didn't want to cry out here in the hall, but he might. He had. His legs hurt all the time, and he wanted his dope, not the heavy-duty aspirin they gave him at the hospital dispensary. He wanted his good dope, his antidope. And oh, he was so tired all the time. What he needed to prop him up were not those shitty sticks, but his make-believe games and stories. They were the good dope, the never-fail fix, but they had all fled. It seemed playtime was finally over. This is what it's like after the end, he thought, opening the door and tottering into the apartment. This is why no one ever writes it. It's too fucking dreary. She should have died after I stuffed her head full of blank paper and busted pages. And I should have died then, too. At that moment, if at no other, we really were like characters in one of Annie's chapter plays. No grays, only blacks and whites, good and bad. I was Jeffrey and she was the Burka Bee goddess. This... Well, I've heard of denouement, but this is ridiculous. Never mind the mess back there on the floor. Drinky poo first. Pick up a poo second. First be a don't be, and then be a... He stopped. He had time to realize the apartment was too dark, and there was a smell. He knew that smell. A deadly mixture of dirt and face powder. Annie rose up from behind the sofa like a white ghost, dressed in a nurse's uniform and cap. The axe was in her hand, and she was screaming, "Time to rinse, Paul. Time to rinse." He shrieked, tried to turn on his bad legs. She leaped the sofa with clumsy strength, looking like an albino frog. Her starched uniform rustled briskly. The first sweep of the axe did no more than knock the wind from him. This was really what he thought until he landed on the carpet, smelling his own blood. He looked down and saw he was cut nearly in half. "Rinse!" she shrieked. And there went his right hand. "Rinse!" she shrieked again, and his left was gone. He crawled toward the open door on the jetting stumps of his wrists, and incredibly the galleys were still there, the bound galleys Charlie had given him at lunch in Mr. Lee's, sliding the manila envelope to him across gleaming white napery, while Muzak drifted down from overhead speakers. "Annie, you can read it now," he tried to scream, but only got out, "Annie, you." before his head flew off and rolled to the wall. His last dimming glimpse of the world was his own collapsing body and Annie's white shoes standing astride it. Goddess, he thought, and died. Scenario: an outline or synopsis, a plot outline, Webster's New Collegiate. Writer: one who writes, especially as an occupation, Webster's New Collegiate. Make-believe: pretense or pretend, Webster's New Collegiate. Polly: can you? Yes, of course he could. The writer was still alive, although he understood this was only make-believe. He really did go to lunch with Charlie Merrill. All the conversation was the same. Only when he let himself into his apartment, he knew it was the cleaning woman who had pulled the drapes, and although he fell down and had to smother a scream of fright, when Annie rose up like Cain from behind the sofa, it was just the cat. Cross-eyed Siamese named Dumpster he had gotten last month at the pound. There was no Annie, because Annie had not been a goddess at all. Only a crazy lady who had hurt Paul for reasons of her own. Annie had managed to pull most of the paper out of her mouth and throat, and had gotten out through Paul's window while Paul was sleeping the sleep of drugs. She had gotten to the barn and had collapsed there. She was dead when Wicks and McKnight found her, but not of strangulation. She had actually died of the fractured skull she had received when she struck the mantle. And she had struck the mantle because she had tripped. So in a way, she had been killed by the very typewriter Paul had hated so much. But she'd had plans for him, all right. Not even the axe would suffice this time. They had found her outside of Misery the Pig's stall, with one hand wrapped around the handle of her chainsaw. That was all in the past, though. Annie Wilkes was in her grave. But like Misery Chastain, she rested there uneasily. In his dreams and waking fantasies, he dug her up again and again. You couldn't kill the goddess. Temporarily dope her with bourbon, maybe, but that was all. He went to the bar, looked at the bottle, then looked back at where his galleys and walking sticks lay. He gave the bottle a goodbye look and worked his way back to his stuff. Rinse. Half an hour later, he was sitting in front of the blank screen, thinking he had to be a glutton for punishment. He had taken the aspirin instead of the drink, but that didn't change what was going to happen now. He was going to sit here for 15 minutes or maybe half an hour, looking at nothing but a cursor flashing in darkness. Then he was going to turn the machine off and have that drink. Except he had seen something funny on the way home from lunch with Charlie, and it had given him an idea. Not a big one, just a small one. After all, it had only been a small incident. Just a kid pushing a shopping cart up 48th Street, that was all. But there had been a cage in the cart, and in it had been a rather large, furry animal which Paul at first thought was a cat. A closer look had shown him a wide, white stripe up the cat's back. "Sonny," he said, "is that a skunk?" "Yeah," the kid said, and pushed the shopping cart along a little faster. He didn't stop long for conversations with people in the city, especially weird-looking guys with bags the size of Samsonite two-suiters under the eyes, who were lurching along on metal walking sticks. The kid turned the corner and was gone. Paul went on, wanting to take a cab, but he was supposed to walk at least a mile every day, and this was his mile, and it hurt like hell. And to take his mind off the mile, he started wondering where that kid had come from, where the shopping cart had come from, and most of all, where the skunk had come from. He heard a noise behind him and turned from the blank screen to see Annie coming out of the kitchen, dressed in jeans and a red flannel logger shirt, a chainsaw in her hand. He closed his eyes, opened them, saw the same old nothing, and was suddenly angry. He turned back to the word processor and wrote fast, almost bludgeoning the keys. One. The kid heard a sound in the back of the building, and although the thought of rats crossed his mind, he turned the corner anyway. It was too early to go home because school didn't let out for another hour and a half, and he had gone truant at lunch. What he saw crouched back against the wall in a dusty shaft of sunlight was not a rat, but a great big black cat with the bushiest tail he had ever seen. He stopped, heart suddenly pounding. Polly, can you? This was a question which he did not dare answer. He bent over the keyboard again, and after a moment began to hit the keys, but more gently now. It wasn't a cat. Eddie Desmond had lived in New York City all his life, but he had been to the Bronx Zoo, and Christ, there were picture books, weren't there? He knew what that thing was, although he hadn't the slightest idea how such a thing could have gotten into his deserted East 105th Street tenement. But the long white stripe down its back was a dead giveaway. It was a skunk. Eddie started slowly toward it, feet gritting in the plaster dust. He could. He could. So in gratitude and terror, he did. The hole opened, and Paul stared through at what was there, unaware that his fingers were picking up speed, unaware that his aching legs were in the same city, but unaware that he's weeping as he wrote. Lovell, Maine, September 23rd, 1984. Bangor, Maine, October 7th, 1986. Now my tale is told. This has been a presentation by Penguin Highbridge Audio.